My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of the Good, the Bad, and the Hungy AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines, and we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungy every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
Kids, you like pro wrestling? Well, we like pro wrestling too. This week in the news, Jeff Cobb and WWE, and the lazy river of wrestling criticism, AEW Revolution and NXT Roadblock, and Invader Club, we talk Barry Windham's turn and watch Luger and Windham versus Tully and Arn from Clash of the Champions 1. This is Shake Them Ropes. He is Chris Novembrino. I am Jeff Hawkins. And for those of you who are relatively new to the show, Chris has given up a lot of his social media and being in the quote-unquote wrestling bubble, so he is a pretty good barometer of things that normal, I'd say more than casual, but people who like to keep an interest in wrestling, fans, think, etc. And so I'm going to start with this, Chris.
I would say I'm like normie adjacent.
You're normie adjacent. I mean, you know. I tell you things that are going on, but I mean, you're not actively out there seeking wrestling news.
No, I never would call myself a normie because, like, you know, I closed captioned the product for 7 years.
Right, you are.
Yeah. But like at this point, I don't sit on any of these websites yearning for scoops or jonesing for scoops. I get looped in on what I need to know for the show, and I watch what I need to watch for the show mostly. And I like that coughed and laughed at the same time. And I guess that makes me more normal than some of the rest of you losers on Discord.
You're smarter than the average bear is what we're trying to say here.
Sure. Yeah. I would say more normal than the Discord people.
That's a low bar. So I'm going to ask you this. Do you know who Speedball Mike Bailey is?
I do know who Speedball Mike Bailey is.
Did you when he debuted?
I knew who he was when he debuted, but mostly through name check.
Right.
I've never actually seen a Speedball match.
Okay, good. Then you're relatively normal and you're relatively on par with a lot of those fans at AEW. Tony decided to basically do Mystery Vortex on AEW and announced a tournament the night before Dynamite, this international dynasty qualifier tournament, put him in as a wild card. In the history of AEW, there's been one vignette for Speedball Mike Bailey. It was on a Collision 3 weeks ago. And then it was kind of a lackluster, the people who knew who he was cheered, and everybody else is kind of like, okay, who is this guy? And I like Speedball Mike Bailey a lot. I've watched him a decade ago in PWG. I did. But I now wish to tell Tony Khan that the requirement for debuting somebody on your television must be at least two vignettes and a music video. That's all I want. We need primers on these guys that you're going to pluck from the indies if you want them to be something. Now, it was just one of those things where I'm watching. I'm like, okay, this is good. Nobody knows who he is. And I know where you get, and this is where the Discord types get on. Well, I've known him from the indies and from TNA all these years and blah, 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 blah. I'm like, it's not wrestling on television. It's a professional wrestling product that airs on TV. You need to do the work of conditioning your audience. Conditioning was the word. It's early on Saturday. I don't know my words well, but
no,
yes,
no, no,
condition.
For sure. So I think, I mean, with Mike Bailey, we see the continuing debate philosophically between those who believe that world building inside of your promotion is essential and others who think that you can get by on, let me come up with a term, like the state of the industry, that people are so conversant in the industry that this promotion can just sort of trade on the names and the work that other people have done in the industry elsewhere, absent footage or absent really even being able to tell that story on your own product. And wrestling is not in the cultural zeitgeist like it was in 1998. This is not an extraordinarily hot take for a Saturday morning. But I think if it's not like it was in 97, 98, where a lot of normies had Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock t-shirts, and that meant that even more people were online looking for the next thing that was going to happen in professional wrestling. I think it's extraordinarily presumptuous to assume that people are watching a lot of indie wrestling. And if you're not sure about that, go and look at the numbers for any of these indie pay-per-views in recent years here. They're not particularly strong. They'll tell you how many people are watching these type of shows right now. These wrestlers are good wrestlers, but are wrestlers who are going to need specific presentation on your promotion to be anything. And I think we've seen this proven.
Yeah, surprises are great if they're a giant name in the business. Surprises of indie-rific guys are going to pop about 20% of your live crowd. And then you still need to put in the work.
I even think surprises are overstated.
Yes.
I think Tony Khan has been relying far too much on surprises and J.J. Abrams mystery boxes.
Which are better than David Fincher mystery boxes. What's in the box? Going into the news. For those of you who don't know, WWE is currently in Europe, and thus the air times for Raw will be a little bit different. March 17th, 3 p.m. Eastern from Brussels, March 24th, 4 p.m. Eastern from Glasgow, Scotland, and March 31st, 3 p.m. Eastern from London, England. Also, if you have a VPN, you can watch the SmackDowns live as well on, I believe, Netflix, because that's where the international for there is. That was fun for me yesterday that I didn't have to wait till 5 p.m. Eastern. If you're watching just on USA, those will still be on at 8 p.m. Eastern that time. But, yeah, kind of interesting timing that they're going to be doing basically 3 weeks worth of build in Europe for the stateside WrestleMania.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know that it'll necessarily hurt them.
It won't.
WrestleMania is just a destination show. I think if anything, doing something like a European Road to WrestleMania thing and maybe making that like a leg of the Road to WrestleMania might help with international tours to the United States to see WrestleMania in the future. Provided you don't have Paul Heyman doing the international charm offensive.
May want to explain that to people.
Okay, so for those of you who didn't watch SmackDown last night, he made a joke to the Spanish audience in Spain that next week, what was it, CM Punk's going to be on, but or who's going to be on next week? It was going to be in Italy. But someone's going to appear next week. So the Spanish audience boos because they don't want to have to go to Italy. And Paul Heyman goes, oh, you can buy a ticket over there. It's not like Mussolini controls Italy.
Oh.
This was another one of these, what year is it? Like, it was kind of the Randy Orton time warp effect where I'm like, really, we're making a Mussolini joke in 2025?
Jokes from 1955 that would have killed.
I know. Abe Vigoda called and he wants his joke back.
Look, we'll do the Tokyo Dome, just Hirohito and his people can't come. Oh. Yeah, my favorite part was, since I watched it live yesterday, it was Solo Sikoa kind of accidentally dropping a bit of an F-bomb and Jimmy Uso kind of corpsing over it. That got memory hold from the U.S. broadcast rather quickly, but it's endearing to watch it live. I love just being able to put it on while I'm working and then not have to worry about watching anything in the evening. So that'll be a fun 3 weeks. John Cena in Europe will be interesting too. We'll see how that goes over since he hasn't been there in a while.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, other things that I've been finding interesting is just how they're handling anything specifically centered around the United States, like the United States Championship or anything like that. I'm finding myself interested in listening to the language and how they're choosing to do that dance. Cause they're just trying to be careful. It's a delicate time right now. They're trying to be careful to not get boos when they want to get cheers.
WWE has announced a 4-day residency at the Yuengling Center in Tampa from May 24th to May 27th. Schedule also includes a Saturday night's main event featuring John Cena wrestling and followed by an NXT special that would be going head to head with AEW's Double or Nothing show from Phoenix. So those of you who wanted the petty, you got the petty from the other side. Congratulations. A lot of people would say, oh, they're going to do that anyways. That might be true, but they're going to, but that's a holiday weekend as well. So now they've started to do these residencies on holiday weekends that will now interfere with AEW's plan of putting their big pay-per-views on holiday weekends. Nothing.
The idea of AEW really competing against WWE like that, it feels a bit 2019.
Yeah, a little. At the press conference after Revolution, Big Boom AJ revealed that he, his son, Big Justice, and the Rizzler had all signed AEW contracts.
Boy, if this was 2024, late 2024, this would be the hottest signing in wrestling.
I find that interesting because I know that WWE did have interest in them after that initial AEW run.
But then, like, their star has waned
a bit.
Yeah. And I think I described them on another episode as a pop song.
A little bit. It's a little bit like the Call Me Maybe phenomenon.
Yeah. They are Call Me Maybe or something in terms of an act. It's, we bring the boom. They put out a crappy rap song. There's three of them. Each one of them has a signature tagline thing. And you hear the chorus a few times and you're like, fine.
Although Rizzler still more over than half of the mid card. So,
I mean, I believe that, but it's like ironic over. You know,
yeah, that's,
I mean,
true too. I'm just, or more charisma. How about that? More charisma than, Dark Side of the Ring noted that its new season, which airs Tuesday nights at 10 PM on Vice starting on March 25th. First show will be about Mick Foley versus The Undertaker's Hell in the Cell match. From there, they cover The Sheik, Tony Atlas, Mark Copani as Muhammad Hassan, Eddie Gilbert, Vader, Daphne, Superstar Billy Graham, Ludwig Borga, Tony Holm, and finishes up with Billy Jack Haynes. Any of those pique your interest?
I'm kind of interested in the Ludwig Borga one.
Yeah. He is a thing. Eddie Gilbert will be a good primer. Same with Vader, kind of. I'm actually kind of interested in the Muhammad Hassan one.
Me too.
Because when I first started at Fightful, I know that Mark was talking to Sean Ross Sapp quite a bit because he had done an in-depth interview. But he was also kind of interested at that time in coming back, not necessarily to WWE, but just making a wrestling comeback of some sort. He was working as, I want to say, an assistant principal at a school at the time. But he got done kind of dirty just by news of the day. If you recall the big quote-unquote terrorist angle he did with the Undertaker came on the same day as I believe a British airline got blown up or something like that, and that was basically the end of his career. Billy Jack,
it was a terrible gimmick.
Terrible gimmick, but he did it well.
No, I know. It's just when you look back,
and they
one
did
of the all-time bad Vince gimmicks. Muhammad Hassan is right up there with any number of the other offensive gimmicks come up with.
Well, it didn't start out that way either. It was much like the Usos gimmick, where it's like, we don't want to be the Samoans who do the haka and rip fish heads off and are savages. We are a new breed of that. And that's basically what the Muhammad Hassan was, but for Middle Eastern wrestlers. And then Vince just went heavy into the stereotype and said, the hell with this. And you're like, no, that's not the point. You moron. I'm also kind of interested if they have any modern footage of Billy Jack Haynes. That's a story that's not going to end well. I don't know if you remember that story, do you?
No, I don't.
Killed his wife.
Ooh.
But he's like, he also has like some form of dementia, I believe. He's like in his 70s, late 70s now, I think. Don't think he's passed, but I'd have to look that up. But nevertheless, let's move on.
Yeah. You're saying he's single.
Yes, you can swipe right if you want. What is wrong with you? All right, focus, Hawkins. So you're saying there's a chance. Fightful reporting that Jeff Cobb is appearing on internal WWE rosters.
Oh.
He's 42. Some of you might remember him as the former Matanza.
I know him as Matanza. And you know, the thing when he debuted was that I found him to be a little bit miscast because in my head, the way they've been building up Matanza was going to be a very tall guy, like 6'8 or something
like
that. He is not tall.
But he is wide.
He is wide.
And there are options there. See, I wouldn't put him in NXT because he's 42. You put him on the main roster, you can either do the Olympic credibility and do something with Gable and the Creed brothers. I think one of the Creeds is out for a while because he's doing, he's helping a fighter train, or he's helping the Ultimate Fighter reality show. So you put him there. I take a Brutus Creed, Jeff Cobb tag team. Hell yeah. You could do Bloodline adjacent. Maybe. I don't know. See, the thing is, because he's not tall, you already have Jacob Fatu, who isn't as tall as you think, but I think he's taller than Jeff Cobb and does a lot more exciting stuff. And Jeff Cobb could just be, he could be a powerhouse, he could be a bodyguard, he could be something like that.
I'd almost give him a Mr. Hughes style gimmick or something.
That'd be kind of cool. I've heard rumblings, but I have no proof of this, that because Cobb was Matt Riddle's tag team partner back in the day, that this might be, and he might be there to keep Matt Riddle in line if they bring him back. I don't know that for a fact. I don't want that reported. I've just heard rumblings. Yeah, I like Jeff Cobb. I just don't know what you do with him right now because that top part is so heavy. He could be a hired goon and be pretty good, but that's like, I mean, then what do you do after that 3 month initial run where he's the hired goon, so to speak? You kind of have a, not Tama Tonga, but maybe a Tonga Loa problem.
Yeah.
There.
Yeah, no, you just have this guy who's sort of a personalityless heel who is not a top level trajectory guy, so they have shorter stories, and
yes,
this is where having a character really saves you. You know, if you've got a character, you can move from one short story to the next short story to the next short story. But like, how do you do that as kind of vanilla heavy? I don't know. I mean, I guess he's an okay hire. I think I like him more as a bodyguard NPC than I do as a wrestler right now. But, you know, he could.
His aura is his strength. So the less you do of him,
right,
and the more strength based spots you could do of him. Oh man, that's really impressive. There you
yeah,
go.
Yeah, right. I think the kind of China presentation is the move here, right? You have him stand menacingly outside the ring. Occasionally he does a move and it just absolutely wrecks somebody. And we see for months this guy outside of the ring doing like a clothesline or something. And I mean, you know, here's an idea. You pair him with some skinny talker guy, not Miz.
Everybody's thinking Miz.
No, I hate the Miz. I'm so done with the Miz and his no growth. Like, but someone a new younger.
How about Mello
would be good, right? Yeah, you have Mello out there, and Mello's doing his thing. He's doing his flashy thing, but the reason he's winning all these matches is because of his big heavy guy,
yeah,
Jeff Cobb outside.
Yeah, I could go with that. And yeah. I'm a big fan of the Mr. Hughes look. The sunglasses, the scowl, yeah, the suit. I love the whole thing. Although that's dangerously close to what they're doing with the Secret Hervis, the Scottish Secret Service for Chelsea Green.
Oh, I thought they were called the Secret Purpose.
No, and no. They're making fun of the accent, so they call it a Secret Hervis.
Oh, I thought that I was actually cackling last night because I thought Chelsea Green referred to them as her secret purpose.
Which she might be as part of the joke, if I can remember it.
Yeah, yeah, the secret purpose I think is actually quite hilarious. Like, hey, dude.
And ending with this, which is kind of intriguing, Paul Walter Hauser. Golden Globe winner, Emmy Award winner, big wrestling fan, was at AEW, Revolution last week. New executive producer of MLW. Oh, Court Bauer, you magnificent huckster, you. Just bringing on the Hollywood money. I think that means a financial investment in it. I don't know for sure, but he will be, and he's been wrestling a little bit for them, but he will be involved in it. Yet another Hollywood guy who likes pro wrestling getting involved with pro wrestling. See Prince, Freddie.
Yeah. Cool.
I like him a lot. He's also a fantastic actor. They're doing something with him and QT Marshall though, from the pre-show of AEW. So that may end up on our TV screens, but, we'll go from there to the lazy river of wrestling criticism. Whatever we watched, whatever we saw. Been a lot of talk about AEW Revolution. Chris, were you able to watch it at all?
I've watched strips and drabs of it. Specifically, I wanted to see the people had a lot, at least the people I knew had things to say about Moxley and Cope. And so I wanted to see where people's thoughts were coming from. So that was actually the first thing I ended up watching. And then
interesting. Okay, hold on then. What did you think of it just in a bubble then before you watched the other stuff?
I think Moxley is boring as hell now.
Okay, because there were some negative thoughts about that match, especially when you had like three, maybe four main event style matches right before it. Look, I'm not going to say Revolution wasn't a good show because it was a very good show. I think if my critique of it was excessiveness at times in terms of the matches wanted to tell you three stories, and they wanted to tell you four different, and wanted to do four different really cool things. And the thing, I nailed the Spanish fly off the cage. I can't believe that happened. I nailed it. But, you know, and it's one of these things where, like, wrestling commentary, it wanted to do the head-to-head of the Fletcher-Osprey cage match with the Punk-Rollins cage match. And they were two entirely different things to me that you could like both of them. And like that, those stories. I just, to me.
But I think there's also like a prioritization thing where if you don't like cage matches that are not centered around trying to escape the cage, then you're not going to like this match as much. I think there are people for whom... maybe I'll dub it the murder cage style of cage match is perfectly fine. They're having a hardcore match. They're having a hard. See, I like it, to me, the whole story of the cage match is it's got to be centered around the cage and the escapage of the cage.
Okay.
So I don't want the murder cage match is what I'm saying. I want the one that's about escaping the cage.
Oh, okay. See, I don't like... see, for me, my issue with the Fletcher match was the entire Mark Davis thing. Coming into the cage with the bag of tricks, not with the rest of the Callis family, to just beat up Will Ospreay and give Fletcher the win. See, I guess I'm in between you because
that's what I'm saying. Like, I want it, to me, the whole point is a cage match, like the heel should be backed into the cage. He should not want to be in the cage.
Right.
And the baby face should be thrilled to death that he's finally got his stipulation, or she's finally got her stipulation that allows her to finally get the weasel cornered. And then we see the weasel do tricks and do other things to try to survive being trapped in the cage, you know, like a scared animal. I think once you lose that energy, it's just two dudes having a hardcore match in a cage.
I agree with that, but I hate the escape the cage thing. Because it's been abused too much by WWE because
I just think the heel should be trying to, whether
the heel should not like it.
The heel should be trying to get to the exit metaphorically, if not literally.
Yes.
You know what I mean? If you don't want to have the Vince McMahon open door cage thing, fine. If you don't want to have the climb out thing, fine.
Okay.
But the heel should be trying to end the match as fast as possible. The heel should not be tickled pink that he's finally got the baby face in the cage and now he's going to do crazy and sick shit to him.
Right, because the cage is supposed to be the punishment for the heel running all the time. I'm going to keep you in this cage.
Right.
And now you have to face me. No, I agree with. My problem has been, and this, look, this is even true of one of my favorite matches, you know, the 92 War Games. I don't like matches where the stipulation is a plot point to then get around the stipulation somehow. Like, yeah, we're going to have this, we're going to have Hell in a Cell, but we're going to climb up to the top of the cell to do things.
No, this is what makes the Foley Undertaker Hell in a Cell match, I think, sort of a wonderfully divisive subject matter. It is at once an extremely entertaining match, but also, in terms of pure fundamentals, in my opinion, a bad cage match. Why did either one of them need to get out of the cage and climb up onto the top of it? Well, like the psychology of this match was just all over the place.
Ricochet Swerve was very good, but again, we tried to tell three stories at once. We had the robe, we had the love of Nana, and was Nana really done with Swerve? And then we also had the Ricochet Swerve grudge type thing. I mean, it was quite good, don't get me wrong. I actually, my favorite match of the night was Hangman MJF, which I thought was a lot of fun. MJF always wants to be the curtain jerker so he can get out there and fly home. And then we had the Hollywood ending match with Mariah May and Toni Storm, and boy, it was the exact opposite of what we talked about on here. It was a hardcore bloody blood feud, Taipei death match in the middle of it, with them wrapping their hands in tape and putting them in sugar glass for the most part. Here's my thing. If you wanted to have that match, yeah, sure, you could have made it the main event in LA, but then don't do Grand Slam Brisbane with those two and switch the belt. Do that and switch the belt there in LA. And it would, and yes, that could have been your main event there for like the Sam Shipmans of the world, who were just like rattling the sabers that the women's match was the hottest feud in the company, kind of a thing. And then you get to Moxley and
I don't know that I would contend that, but I would say it differently and more as an indictment on the top of the card.
Okay. That I think that's fair too. And then Moxley and Cope have to follow all these bloody stabbing guys with screwdrivers and stuff in the middle of the cage too. That's, you know.
Like, all right, no. So you have two guys who are about 5 to 7 years older than everyone else, and look at the material they have to go out there and work with, right up to this Christian Cage stuff.
Which is why they're doing the street fight next week. That match will be fine. It'll be good. But this is like the Edge Mox prototype. It's like, well, that match didn't go over like we wanted it to. Let's run it back in a more hardcore style and win the fans back type of a thing. This was a
Stanford
special almost.
Yes, and like this next match will be fine, but it does very much have the Kenny Omega, John Moxley
yes.
match with sparklers vibes to it.
Omega Takeshita was really good. I liked that a lot, and it revolved around the story of the gut. The problem is, the gut stops being sold about 2/3 of the way through the match. And I get it. It's just one of those things where it's like, I'm more on the Nov DDP end, where the ribs become a hindrance towards the end of the match versus something that we've been working on through part of the match and then kind of disappears through adrenaline.
Takes
yes.
us over. No, yes. I know. And to me, I don't know that they view it this way, but I would be thinking about Kenny Omega as my perennial upper mid-carder now, and with his ribs as my perennial out for how I can get Kenny Omega out of the title picture when I need to get him out of the title picture. I have the gut now to work with, and I also have the gut as a built-in babyface story for him.
Can I be the person to say I liked the save of Christian signing the contract and still losing the match, of him saying, no, I signed the contract for a one-on-one, not a three-way, even though he's cashing it in the middle of the match. I kind of liked the save on that, even though it was utterly ridiculous for the amount of just chicanery in that match. I mean, nobody, I hate when things like the Jay White spot happen and people are going, did Jay White do that on purpose?
Oh my God.
No, of course he didn't do it on purpose. You dopes. Now we have to bring that into the conversation, even though nobody in their right mind thought it.
No, but we're still, he might turn heel. Like
he's going to turn heel. That's yeah,
right.
No,
I know. He didn't do it. He's going to, this is the stuff I hate.
And this time he's going to mean it. And you're just like, oh, God, stop
boy.
It.
And the Death Riders stuff still makes really no sense. And like, to your point, it's like, okay, I like Christian kvetching the night after, except that, like, the Nick Wayne, Mama Wayne stuff.
That's a swerve too, I bet.
That felt like that just didn't really,
I don't know. No, it should have been much far more subtle to me. It should have been like Nick Wayne going, you should have stuck with the plan. Like after, like they say cut and the camera accidentally is keeping rolling. And Nick Wayne just kind of gives him a side, like you should have stuck with the plan. And Cage is still kind of mad about it.
I think especially if you're going to swerve it, I think I would have had Mama Wayne slap Christian when he got in Nick Wayne's face.
Yeah.
And have like Christian storm off with Kip Sabian. And make it look like the family's falling apart.
Yeah, because this feels like a complete and utter swerve.
No, I know. It definitely does. And it also is one of these things where I don't care still. Like,
yeah.
Kip Sabian What is he there to do other than to look like Christian when he was younger?
I think this will be the time to for me to talk about the little bit of trouble. I don't know if it's trouble. It's just an argument I got into with Joe and Rich. Will Ospreay, after this, was like, if I were in WWE, those fans would be wanking into their handkerchiefs. And I quote tweeted this and I said, I don't really think so. I think if Will Ospreay had gone to, and I said, if he had gone to WWE and started on the main roster, and if he was built the same way AEW built him, which was 70-30 matches where the other guy got 70% for the most part, and then Will comes out with his fantastic thing, or even if you didn't do it that way, even if you did it like Penta, he'd still basically be in kind of a Penta position fighting against a Ludwig Kaiser or a Carmelo Hayes on SmackDown, kind of in that mid-card, not necessarily the upper card. And the reason for this, I said, was because American fans and even WWE fans have a prototype of what they see as a star. Someone who's like 6'3", 6'4", kind of built, although Cody kind of goes against that grain, who can talk smack and is a bit of an ass kicker. That's what they want. They want guys who talk smack, kick ass, kind of built, kind of not built like them, who look the part. It's central casting. And I'm not saying that as a derogatory comment towards Will Ospreay's wrestling talent, because the prototype for Will, you can look at an AJ Styles or a Ricochet, and both have various strengths and various weaknesses from what they were brought in to WWE, but Will Ospreay does not convey instant star necessarily that WWE fan base wants. And there's nothing wrong with that. I got jumped down the throat like, well, you don't think Will Ospreay's an ass kicker after that cage match? And I was like, no, he was bloody for a match. That's what that was. I mean, he got
had an ass kicking match.
Yes.
Guys, it is the difference between going to Hot Topic, buying a bunch of black clothing that's baggy, putting it on for an evening, and calling yourself a goth versus owning every album that Cradle of Filth has ever made and listening to it every day. Like, you can do something for an evening, which is what Will Ospreay did. He had an ass-kicking match, but he is not dressed like an ass kicker in terms of ring presentation. It's shiny, high fly-y outfitting. It is the type of outfitting that suggests I'm a guy who flies in the sky. And to wit, his name is the Aerial Assassin. So going back to your comps here of Ricochet and AJ Styles, if we're thinking about how Will would have done in a revisionist history where, let's suppose, McMahon had been out of the company for the last 5 years and not, you know, kind of any outy, and that would have maybe messed up Will Ospreay's presentation there. I think the answer is, well, Will, you probably would have done about as good as they would have booked you, which means if they had booked you AJ Styles when he first came into the company and he was having the matches against John Cena and was being presented as an elite global level talent, of which high flying stuff is part of his aspect, that'd be one thing. But if you come into the company and you're presented like Ricochet, or someone else, a generic high flyer guy, the equivalent of a Vikingo in AEW, only over in WWE, he's not going anywhere. And I don't think it's irrelevant. The accent's not working for him. It's working right. Slightly against him. He would need to have a really strong character.
And WWE is WWE. They haven't changed that. Like, AJ Styles came in with the big pop at the Rumble, but then got into that Mania program with Chris Jericho. And this show got hot because everybody called Jeff Hawkins a moron when he said, I think Chris Jericho's going over AJ Styles because AJ Styles isn't a guy that they built. And yes, this was what the Vince McMahon plan was. You take a guy that other people have built, you bring him in with a great debut, and then you break him down and you build him back up to make him your guy. And they still have a little bit of that in the Hunter and HBK are still guys who think people need a little bit of adversity when they come in, when they've been hot crap somewhere else. And also, you need to learn our style. You need to learn that, like, people all the time bitch about, oh, yes, to find the hard cam. No, it's about learning how they do television, how they present characters, how your promo is supposed to be. It's supposed to be an exposition-y story, you know, the type of stuff I don't generally like, but if you're good at it, you can pull it off. You know, it's about... You can be good at a job somewhere, go to another company. They still want you to learn how that company does it, even if you were very good at another place. And that's, you know, that's all my real point was. But it was taken far out of context, I think, or in terms of saying something that I wasn't trying to say. And that,
well, I mean, I think the people want one match to forgive nearly 2 years of inconsistent upper mid-card presentation of a guy who was brought in to be the banner baby face of the company.
Yeah.
When this guy still has not had a real storyline of import against the Death Riders, the faction that's nominally been in control of the company for the better part of 9 months now.
It is your turn, sir, and there's some good stuff to pick from.
There is some good stuff to pick from here. So now we've done Revolution. This was a solid week of mid-card matches, I thought.
Yes.
I'll start off with this. Last night, I loved the Axiom and Walter match.
Yeah.
I thought that was so good.
That was a lot of fun. It was fun to get him in front of his hometown or his home country. And he's the guy who should lose to, but this is also... Man, I want to say I saw this at PWG when he was still a kid, because I think he did one show for them, and I thought he went up against Walter before he began. You know, we use Walter and Gunther here interchangeably, so it's fine. But it's like that. No, that the small guy, giant dude who will kill you match is always a fun one for me. I like that a lot. Continue, sir.
Yeah, no, I think that, you know, when Walter Gunther comes out and does his promos, he does a really nice job as a heel.
Yes.
Getting over the baby face. Like he really understands that art. And that's tricky, right? Like he managed to actually, for the people who had not seen A-Kid or who don't watch, you know, NXT every week, aren't familiar with what Axiom's doing on NXT, and boy, are you missing out.
Yes.
Because, God, Axiom and Nathan Frazier are outstanding. Gunther does a really nice job getting you into context and getting that match to mean something in the context of his storyline here. And that Spanish crowd was all over that. So no, I really liked that. I guess I will give you one from,
I'm about to wax poetic on that NXT show, but I'll give you one more from SmackDown. I really like DIY versus the Street Profits.
Oh, yeah. That was a nice little match.
And it was finally, yeah, I mean, the Street Profits haven't held those titles, I think, in a year and a half. And I think they're going to play hot potato with them to get this multi-team match on the Mania card. I think possibly Pretty Deadly's winning them back next week against the Street Profits. Montez Ford is still a million friggin' bucks. And Angelo Dawkins is so vastly underappreciated for the amount of work he's put in to get better and to be more of a, to be more, I mean, we'll talk about this in Vader Club, but so much of tag team wrestling was ruined by the Shawn Michaels turn on Marty Jannetty, where you're looking for the one guy who's the star of the team and the other guy who isn't. They're both stars in their own way on that Street Profits team. They're just a fantastic team. But, oh, did you want to add something? Sorry.
No, I agree.
This NXT show on Tuesday was sublime.
What's going on, guys? This is Rich from the Flagship Podcast here on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. We'll get back to your show in just a minute. Do want to let you know about a brand new sponsor, though, we have on the network, NordVPN. NordVPN aims to make the internet a better place for everybody. You can free your internet from online threats, censorship, and surveillance, as well as access content that is not available in your region. And this was one of the great ways that I use NordVPN, which is already moving all their content to another streaming service internationally. You can use NordVPN to switch your region and access everything that they have on that new service. Now, on the flip side, say you still want access to where WWE used to have their content, and maybe you live outside the United States. Well, hey, NordVPN, again, is there to help. It's not just wrestling, though. If there's a sporting event or a TV show that's unavailable where you live, do not worry. You can still watch it with NordVPN. Just switch your virtual location to a country that is showing it. Plus, NordVPN is a great way to protect your private data, like bank details and passwords, especially when you're traveling and using public Wi-Fi. One of the things that I love about NordVPN is that you can save money on flights, hotels, and subscriptions by virtually changing your location to a country with lower prices. As someone who travels a lot, you guys know vacations and all the other stuff. This is a tool that I use all the time to score better deals. Shop smarter with NordVPN. Come on, what are you doing? And don't worry about slow streaming either. NordVPN is the fastest VPN out there, so no more buffering or lagging. It even has a threat protection feature that blocks viruses and phishing sites. Best of all, you can use one account on up to 10 devices, and it costs about the same as a cup of coffee each month. Now, to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to our link, nordvpn.com/voice, which will give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. Again, it's nordvpn.com/voice to get 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. Best of all, there's no risk. Nord has a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you're not happy, use that right there, 30-day money-back guarantee. Once again, that's nordvpn.com/voice to get 4 extra months on the 2-year NordVPN plan. One more time, nordvpn.com/voice to get 4 extra months on the 2-year NordVPN plan. And, of course, we want to thank NordVPN for sponsoring the podcast network. Now, back to your show.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
And I wish they would categorize it with the takeovers so I could go back and watch it occasionally as opposed to having to look through the weekly television and remember the date of it. 5 matches, not a dud amongst them. You might be a little bit down on the Roxanne-Jordan Grace match, but it was still solid.
It wasn't bad. It wasn't bad. It was the same thing with Javon Evans and Ethan Page. Neither were bad. It's just like, I don't know, your mileage may vary with how into either one of those stories slash matches you were.
Yeah. I'm kind of at a loss of where to start because there's so many places, but
I'll hit you with this. I thought Fraxium and the Hardy Boys over-delivered.
Whew. Yes. Jeff came to play, as did Matt. Matt looked like he found the fountain of youth for a day.
I know. Someone gave him the cortisone shots, all of the cortisone shots.
Because, I mean, you watch him at the end.
I have not seen him be that mobile in like 10 years.
No.
And we've watched a lot of Matt Hardy moving in slow motion.
Oh, God. In AEW, he looked like he was like he needed a walker to get around towards the end of his career there because it was just like, he was trying. I mean, he looked 20 years younger in that match. And Frazier and Axiom are just, they hit the right pace, which for them is it's a solid thing because Frazier is usually about playing at 1.5 speed and he's going way too fast for the other guys. But no, that thing was great. I'll go back to Oba and Moose in a moment, but I wanted to, since you had brought it up, I wanted to bring up Ethan Page, because Ethan Page, we've been talking about him on this show for a long time, but I think, again, we really don't give the breadth of what he's done in his career enough credit, because like, I remember I talked about them when he and Josh made their debut at PWG in, I think, 2014. I may have the year wrong on that, against, I think it was the Beaver Boys. Alex Reynolds and John Silver now of the Dark Order. He was good, and he was great at working a crowd and was great with his mouth. And then he was kind of pudgy. You know, he had some size to him. He went to TNA and Impact and started doing the Karate Man stuff and doing the comedy shtick. And then during the pandemic, he decided he was going to become a body guy. And he really worked his ass off into getting into great shape and to building a lot more muscle on his frame and to really taking that cosmetic part of the business seriously. And now you bring him in after his run in AEW, where he had great programs with Darby. He had a fun short program with Kenny Omega on a Collision when he was like a Canadian hero for that. And also with MJF, he had that like 1 week title program when they were doing that Canadian run, and MJF was the title, and he came out as the baby face of Canada and got mad over in that match, and then they did nothing with him after that. He was great with Dan Lambert and the not the Alpha Males, what were they called, him and Scorpio Sky. It was some convoluted name that I can't remember, but they were great in that. I mean, he's been great in everything, and he comes into NXT and everybody's just like, oh, is this a downgrade or whatever? And he's doing the job he should be doing, which is getting these young guys a bit of a rub on personality while also just being a solid worker and being a base for a guy like Javon Evans. He's gotten to do a sketch with The Rock, and he held his own in it. And I think, you know, he is just such a multi-tool player that we go, yeah, he's solid, but it's like, you don't understand.
We used to say this in AEW, is that they just completely were not utilizing this guy at all. He was just never even sniffing the title picture. And this guy has all of the things you need to be at minimum a perennial title contender in your main event scene.
Like he could come up.
The good match. He has the good promo. He has good story. He can work as a manager, he can work as a talker, he can work as a worker.
He could come up right now and be in a great feud with LA Knight.
Yeah.
If they wanted to, I wouldn't debut him and then give him the title. I hate that. Let's build a guy and then give him the title match. But I just wanted to wax poetic a bit about that. Let's stay on NXT and you can go.
Moose versus Obafemi. Lovely coming out party for Oba here, because I have felt like up to now that a lot of Oba's matches have been very contingent on the other person carrying him. And obviously Moose is the veteran here, but Oba did his work in this match, and he's clearly a raw physical specimen. What he lacks in terms of ring psychology and selling can be easily overcame when he is in the ring against big monstrous dudes. And I also think those big monstrous dudes can actually make Obafemi sell a little bit.
Moose possibly earned himself a job with this match.
If he didn't get a job off of this match, because look, Williams and Obafemi both kind of have needed people to carry them to good matches, and Moose did his job here.
Well, he was on their radar when he originally signed with Ring of Honor.
Yep.
And what scared them off was the domestic abuse allegations, which may not be true. There was a lot of he said, she said in there.
Smoke, but not fire.
Right. But it was enough to scare them off of Moose. Moose came in here, and look, he's a guy who can move. He's very strong. He has legit athletic credentials. And he let Obafemi show his feats of strength against Moose. This is Vader Club worthy. Mm-hmm. This is what I want in my professional wrestling a lot of times. Two big, jacked up, who's the baddest dog in the yard, beating the crap out of each other for my amusement. This is what I want. And look, Obafemi is hugely strong. He was a Division I shot putter. He is hella strong.
He's really strong.
And Moose went up light for him, which is also great. But just, you got to see him work from underneath a little bit as a power guy, which was nice for Obafemi, because it's a little ridiculous watching him against like an Eddie Thorpe, who's you know, who's big but not huge. Trick is kind of it's kind of weird watching him work with Trick, because Trick's mostly kicks and punches type of a thing.
As best as we can tell, Trick's offense
is weird to me.
Is weird. Yeah, no, we were talking earlier about, you know, defining people as like flips guys or kicks guys, like this episode, last episode. And Trick Williams remains this real enigma of like, how would you define his professional wrestling style?
Like, he wants to do knees and kicks, and I'm just like, that's not you, dude.
I know. He wants to do strikes. I don't think that's the move, but, like, there's, like, a dash of Booker T in there.
Yes.
And, like, but he's a very confused
match. You know what it is?
There,
you know what I think it is? I can't say this for sure, but this is the we need to make him more well-rounded dilemma, where it's like, oh, he should be this one thing and doing it very well, but we need to give him the skills of a well-rounded wrestler. And so you become a guy who's not very good at anything.
I know, and I guess it's also a question of, you got to visualize what is kind of, with Trick's frame and everything, what looks the best on him. I guess that's how they got to strikes. He's got very long legs.
Yes.
Like, he doesn't have the frame that makes suplexes look stiff. He really shouldn't be doing high flying like that.
He should not be a technical wrestler, and he shouldn't be doing strong style necessarily. I mean,
okay, so now by process of elimination,
Street Fighter. Make him a Street Fighter.
I'd actually kind of like him to be, I think, that roughneck.
Yes.
Slightly, not like slightly rule breaking, even as a babyface. Like always knows how to take that street shortcut.
Chip on his shoulder.
Yeah.
Street Fighter. Yeah, no, that's... And then I guess since there's a one match left, I'll let you start with Julia and Stephanie Vaquer.
You know, Julia and Stephanie Vaquer, both of these two talents have been quality imports for NXT. I think they just elevate the work level on the show here and help make these cards really nice. I guess it begs the question to me of, Do Julia and Stephanie Vaquer still need to be on NXT at this point? I mean, I feel like both of them are pretty capable of working on the main roster, or working along with most of these main roster talents, at least in the middle of the card.
They are, but I will say this. Number one, Julia, slightly banged up, but also dealing with a visa issue, and then she'll be back. I would say right now, and this, my other co-host and I have been actually debating this very thing. I think Stephanie's ready. Stephanie has the TV charisma down. Like, she's throwing looks. Like, she's part of my friend. She's eye fucking the camera at times when she's doing her match before she does that move that drives Booker T nuts. I mean, she gives a look like she knows exactly what she's doing with that move and who she's appealing to with it right before she does it. Julia, to me, comes off as a bit awkward.
Yeah.
In terms of the charisma stuff.
Maybe there's something lost in translation with her charisma.
I'm thinking that, too. I'm thinking she needs to get a little bit better with the English. She has a weird...
I'm not even saying that. I'm saying that, like, there are certain mannerisms and things that
yes.
play one way overseas and play differently here. Not even things that she's saying. Just
okay.
Carriage.
Well, the carriage thing for me is the big thing, because she has a weird gait to her that I don't
yes.
know. I mean, it's. I mean, she's tall and she's thin, but she kind of holds her shoulders a little slump when she comes out. I think she thinks she's portraying something that she's not portraying on TV.
I think the pixie girl Japanese character in wrestling is a little played out at this point too. I think audiences can accept a Japanese wrestler without them fitting into their manic pixie dream girl fantasy.
Yeah, and it's just she has a bit of a scowl on her face when she's doing it. It comes off.
I mean, she's, you know, the thing is, she's very strikingly attractive.
Yes, she is.
I would just have her present differently. Like, maybe go more just the straight black thing. Like, the heavy colors thing, I don't think is doing her anything.
More Asuka in the beginning, I guess, than she almost comes off as.
Before it looked like a pastel set exploded on her.
Yes, like she's coming off a bit like the goth chick from The Incredibles, voiced by Sarah Val, you know, kind of that she has kind of like the hangdog look, a bit of a scowl, the lurching shoulders as she comes out. And I think maybe go a bit more into the Beautiful Madness character and say, hey, let's find that a little bit in your, just in the way you're carrying yourself. I think she's carrying herself like she did in Japan, but there's something that's not quite clicking on the American carriage until she gets in the ring and starts fighting.
It definitely gets better once the match gets rolling. It's fine.
Cause she's comfortable there. I think what she's conveying is I'm uncomfortable doing this.
Yeah, and I think the Beautiful Madness thing is tricky too, in terms of they have this tagline, but that tagline's not necessarily, you know, linked directly to an act. Like, you know, if you,
yes,
because it's like, all right,
like Aerial Assassin,
right? Like it sounds like it's more than it is. Is exactly how I feel about both of those. The Beautiful Madness thing, it's like, all right, I'm thinking about backstage. Would they be kind, but you could kind of say something that pisses them off and then they become almost sadistic? And then isn't that,
I was thinking
it's almost like a Waylon Mercy sort of thing.
Or like it's almost like the character that Io thinks she's portraying at times, where she's right, just a little bit crazy in the ring. But, you know,
yeah, but, and again, this gets back to I'm just over kind of the manic pixie presentation, yeah, with these characters. We got to come up with something better in 2025.
By the way, just to jump right back to Raw real quick.
Old Shake Them Ropes, dated and behind the times, always defending the retrograde.
Yes, pretty much. Kid Sister Io. Once she gets there, it's fantastic. Getting there can be a problem because it's like you're watching her and she's playing for the back of the crowd, but it's also like, oh, how can I be mad at that? It's so cute. But once she gets there and starts smacking Bianca and Rhea, going, no, I'm the champion, then I get into it. But up until that point, it's a very histrionic type of presentation that it takes a little bit. It's like Greg Valentine. It takes an hour to get him warmed up, but once you do, it's great. It's weird because I think Io's getting her due, but I also think she's there to take the fall in the three-way because they don't want to beat Bianca or Rhea. So.
Yeah, no, I am still very hopeful that Bianca's ultimately a heel here.
Yeah, and we were the minority in not liking that Naomi segment.
Oh, did the Jade Cargill segment that followed it up and really move people's hearts and minds?
No, Naomi was good.
No, I thought that Jade this week came off particularly stiff. I hate this
iteration. You mean the sit down with Kathy Kelly?
Yeah.
Yeah, the Liv involvement saved that segment.
That's the only thing that saved it. When Liv Morgan walked on the screen, I was, yes, like, thank God.
Yeah. It hurt my heart. Shut up.
I was dying, and there was Liv. That's how I felt watching Jade Cargill. I just, her stoic, hurt bitchiness, but like, don't want to let that get to me I hate this energy that she's throwing off right now.
Right, because she gives natural heel energy. It's a lot like Britt Baker.
Yes, it does not come off as sympathetic.
No.
But there's nothing in the story that says anything other than she was screwed over. So I don't really know how to feel about Jade Cargill. And then the visual of her just in all black, I guess this is supposed to be like her in mourning. But that also throws off heel vibes in wrestling, too, at the same time. It's weird. Like, this turn happened, and all of them feel more heelish to me.
Yeah, because it's like Jade is this jacked, muscular power wrestler in canon. And she got the drop on her by the likable dancing underdog Naomi. And then Bianca, who's also, you know,
and she's salty about it, right? Like, she can't even go like, oh, I got my number. And clearly she's gotten too over this.
Yes, I can't believe she's the one that took me out. And then Bianca, meanwhile, is just like, this is like, but I'm also powerful in front of Rhea and Io. And you ain't going to talk to me like that. And it's just like everybody's off on the character. And you're just like, what the hell is going on here?
I know. Like, yes, Bianca, to flesh this out, Bianca coming off as this picture of strength and of dominance and everything comes off as this profound bulldog front, because on the exact same television show that I watch, but also all the characters on the TV show watch, we see her like, so like, oh, you're not gonna talk to me like that, I am the EST of WWE. Yes. And then like cut to
my friend turned on me and hurt my tag.
My friends.
it's a little No, I'm not going to say the word because then I'd be seen as insensitive, but Jekyll and Hyde, how about that? We'll go with that. It's a little Jekyll and Hyde.
I'll go with Two-Face. I don't care.
My word was going to start with bye, but I didn't go there because then I'll get, you're making light of such things. No, I'm not. I'm just saying the TV needs to be more consistently written for some people. But I did like that Liv was just like walking out into the arena while they're doing this quiet sit down yakking and interrupting thing. And then there goes Jade. And they just start screaming at each other.
And
go, that's kind of
natural. Feels like the biggest baby face here is Liv.
Yes.
Who was falsely accused, stood her ground. It was like, no, screw you. I didn't attack you. But guess what? I'm looking at you in the eyes right now. If I was gonna do it, you'd know. And guess what? She was telling the truth, and she's been consistent. Unlike the other three of them, Naomi obviously two-faced here, but now we've discussed Bianca and Jade too. Like, I'm supposed to like at least one of the two of them coming out of this. Yes. If not both of them.
And I don't like either of them.
And I don't like either of them. Exactly. The person I like the most coming out of this is, again, Liv.
Liv, who...
who's not trying to win my affections right now.
There was a one-armed man, and he did kill my wife. Liv Morgan is the fugitive. She gets framed for this beating and has to go on the run from the Secret Service or whatever. I have nothing else for my Lazy River. Do you have anything from Raw or SmackDown that's been lingering?
No, other than I just thought both Raw and SmackDown here were really pleasant shows.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Very
despite the inconsistencies, there's pleasant to watch at times.
Yeah, no, I'm talking, I guess specifically, the last couple of weeks here, I feel like I have been routinely treated to really nice mid-card matches.
Yes.
On both Raw and SmackDown, and that's, like, it's really nice to have some solid work matches that I can point to at the end of the show and be like, that was a work match. That,
like,
was a work, yeah, like
Carmelo's matches have been, Andrade has had one last week, I believe. You know, you have Otis last week doing
you know,
well.
You know,
I mean,
I thought B-Fab looked really solid.
B-Fab
in her match.
Looked very improved. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, really solid in her match against Charlotte. That's, I mean, it's, you know, This is B-Fab. I'm not, you know, putting the bar sky high for her or anything like that. But for someone who, one, has always had the visual charisma thing for her, always had that.
Right.
Like, that was never the issue, even when they had the big guy who was top dollar who would break everyone's back. That guy, unsafe top dollar.
He was on the pre-show last night of TNA. I started to watch that show, and then I just got frustrated.
Anyone get hurt?
No.
When she was doing that, that was cool. There was Swerve's faction. And now it's like having her have this long four match against Charlotte, I was curious how long this match was going to go. And then she got a lot of offense in. And Charlotte did a really nice job carrying her and making her look good too. This was not a nothing, no reason little match. This was actually a nice little showing out of it. And I think, I'll say this, Joe Tessitore, minus when he's spamming every Italian word he's ever learned from his grandmother. I too have an Italian grandmother, Joe Tessitore. It's not as charming as you might think. Little bit goes a long way. It's like pesto, Joe. Outside of that, I thought everyone was doing a really nice job throughout that match, making B-Fab seem like she was rising to that next level. Joe Tessitore putting over, she stood up to Charlotte. It basically kind of telling the story of, she's probably not going to win, but at least she stood up to her.
And for someone whose growth is only now on main roster television, I mean, like you said, we're not setting the bar too high, but man, that is difficult, especially if you're not getting a lot of reps. So you're having to do the training on your own time somewhere else with other people. Yeah.
And then you got to come out and show up in front of a Spanish audience, international audience. You traveled, isn't nothing.
Who have high expectations because the company hasn't been in town for a while.
Yeah. And you got to work Charlotte Flair, who's in a high profile Mania program leading into Mania.
That was a nice pull-apart brawl, too. I just wish they hadn't done so many pull-apart brawls to get to it. But the Tiffany, Charlotte, tete-a-tete is kind of fun. But yeah, no, B-Fab, I mean, people buried her on that first match she had on the main roster because it was terrible. And it was like, oh, here we go. Don't answer your phone, B-Fab. The cuts are coming. And perfectly cromulent.
Yeah. I think both her and Electra Lopez kind of got raw deals because they just stopped. They lost shiny new toy syndrome.
Yes.
Too early. And like, if they had both been given three, maybe four more months to kind of pull it together and still been a focused project, both of them would have been there.
Possibly. Yeah. Electra Lopez, she's now no longer with the company. So yeah, she's got
a great talent, but she had camera,
she had charisma.
Problem.
She had
same thing with B-Fab. Like, both of them just have natural camera charisma.
Yes. No, I definitely agree with that. So let's go to Vader Club. I kind of messed up a little bit, and our friend of the show, Jason, pointed this out to me, and I just said, well, I screwed it up already. I've announced it. Let's go with it. But I really wanted to go on, because of John Cena's turn, other important turns in wrestling, at least to my fandom, and I was going with Barry Windham's. And I thought he turned at Clash 1, but he didn't. It was at a house show or a worldwide taping. So I gave Chris basically the worldwide parts from that syndicated show where they went over the angle and what happened and how it came to fruition. But we also watched Barry and Lex versus Tully and Arn from Clash 1, which is a fantastic show, very important show in wrestling history because it went head to head against WrestleMania 4. Except on basic cable.
And a match that will very much make you wish these dudes would have worn different colored tights.
Yes.
Oh, my God. It's small, but it kind of drives me crazy seeing Luger in the same colored tights as the heels.
Barry Windham's an interesting guy because he always had the size and the talent, but in this iteration, this is post Magnum's car accident, and Dusty wants a young superstar, and he has a plethora of choices, but none of them are quite perfect. You have Sting, who will be wrestling in the main event on this card, kind of In a 45-minute draw, even though it's called a 60-minute draw with Flair. He's holding his own, but he's still very, very green. But he has a lot of charisma. Barry, son of one of Dusty's best friends in Blackjack Mulligan, uber-talented, uber-athletic, not a gym guy, though. Doesn't have that kind of look that pops on TV anymore. And then you have Luger, who, for reasons both Lex's and Dusty's, looks like a million bucks. Did not want to be a heel because I think he had movie offers and stuff coming in, and Dusty kind of wanted him on that list of guys I could then make my new future star. And look, well, there have been other turns in wrestling, many of them better, but Barry's kind of came out of nowhere, if I'm recalling it correctly. The thing about WWE is they always kind of tip their hand a little bit. Like the Sean Marty one is always, you know, the angle itself is shocking, but Shawn Michaels had been acting up and acting weird for the weeks prior to that and starting to get an attitude. So you kind of knew it was coming. Barry and Lex, it was more of the story of Lex turning on the Horsemen so could Barry trust him and earning that trust and then getting this tag title match at Clash One, which solid. Look, Arn and Tully are great. I'm always shocked that Arn never wore a robe of some kind. That's always the funniest thing to me. I don't think he wore, I think he may have wore one in Mid-South when he was doing the Mr. Olympia gimmick, but this is when Arn and Tully aren't quite Arn and Tully that we know and love. They're teaming, but they're not that team. And, you know, they're not coming out dressed the same. Tully still has the long robe. Arn still has the satin jacket kind of a look. But I loved this worldwide after the turn where they explain, yeah, we laid the groundwork for this a year beforehand where they didn't show this one, but JJ had cut a promo going, there's going to come a day where you're looking for Lex and he's not going to be there, Barry. And, you know, but they did bring up the one 6 months beforehand where Flair goes, I'd like Barry to be a horseman. And then they pay it off 6 months later without really ever referencing it on TV or anything like that. And it's just so subtle and so good. And it comes out of nowhere, but then it works eventually. And then they bring the Midnight Rider in and it's treated seriously. It's a dumb gimmick. Wrestling Observer people hated it at the time of the year. I think it was considered worst gimmick. Everybody knows it's Dusty, but there's a bounty on getting the mask and proving it's Dusty. And while it's a ridiculous angle, the seriousness with which it's treated, because when he goes into that locker room to face Barry and gets jumped by the heels and they're all yelling, get the mask and show it, because there was a reward for that, because Jim Crockett had basically said, well, if you can prove it's Dusty Rhodes, I'll fire him, or something to that effect. The seriousness with which stupidity is taken is a plus for me in wrestling, so I loved it.
I just love, like, wrestlers named after classic rock songs.
Yes. Stagger Lee.
Yeah.
The Midnight Rider.
We need the Stairway to Heaven as a wrestler.
I think they meant Black Dog. You could have done. Yeah. Maybe. The match itself from Clash is, you know, it's just blue collar solid. The thing that stood out to me about it was the crowd when they won. This is the kind of hot crowds I miss in wrestling when they used to believe it was real. I mean, it may have been sweetened a little, but not by much. I mean, you've watched that crowd when Barry and Luger get the pin on, I believe Arn took the pin. And they're just jumping because they got to see a title switch, which was also very rare back in the day. And this crowd is just on fire. The two good guys have finally overcome those mean, evil horsemen. It's all part of my youth. But I'll ask you this to start off with, and then you can go into anything that caught your eye about either of these things. What's your favorite turn in pro wrestling?
Ooh, my favorite turn in pro wrestling.
I can give you mine while I give you time to think.
Yeah, please.
Because the classic one for me is one where Ole Anderson turned on Dusty Rhodes in Georgia. And Dusty had been looking for a partner for a while. And he and Ole were just blood enemies for a long, long time, but Ole had turned babyface. And so they decided to do this cage match against the Assassins, I think it was. And then they each get to pick a referee. And the Assassins pick Ivan Koloff. And Ole and Dusty pick Gene Anderson. And it's a tag team match in a cage. And all of them just end up jumping Dusty. It's so fantastic. And it's great. And then all the promos afterwards, like the promo Ole cuts where he explains, he came to me and asked for my help, where he's just so happy that he got a chance to finally stick it to Dusty Rhodes. I mean, it's an all-time classic. But there are others. I mean, there's the Freebirds and the Von Erichs. I mean, Flair turning on partners that he'd sucker into matches every so often, always fun. I mean, there are some modern ones. Sammy against the Bloodlines, fun. Dakota Kai on Tegan Knox and during the War Games is still one of the best ones I've seen.
I actually enjoyed the Kevin Owens and Chris Jericho turn.
That one was good. Why is my name on the list?
Yeah, exactly. That was fun. That was fun. As I'm drawing my brain here, I really love the double turn with Bret Hart and Steve Austin. In particular, it's not like a turn like we're talking about here, but I always felt like Bret's heel turns in particular were really good and catalyzed by a precipitating event. He made all of his heel turns feel earned.
I think for him especially, it's because his own heightened sense of self-worth and how good he is in terms of being a wrestler always comes off as heelish, even when he's a babyface at times. Like, he has a bit of a smug allure to even his babyface promos.
Yeah, I mean, his tagline is the excellence of execution.
Best there ever will be. So it always naturally fit. And you always go, yeah, that guy's a natural jerk.
he has a natural ability to rub the wrong way, or like his sense of aggrievement or whatever is injustice always just like, I thought it worked. Because it wasn't overworked. It didn't require, you know, becoming spooky ooky or whatever.
Yeah, and I think that's also why, for me, especially the explainer parts, like they would spend half of an episode explaining why this turn happened or what. They did that with Jimmy Garvin when he turned babyface protecting Ron Garvin.
You know, Mick Foley had some pretty fun turns along the way, too. Like the one, I think it's against Hunter, right, where he goes, turns into Cactus Jack. Like that
yes.
whole promo leading into that's pretty
Yeah,
fun.
That one's fun, too.
Yeah.
But I liked J.J. Dillon as kind of a neutral explainer. Hey, here's how it went down. I was in contact with him for the last couple months. We talk occasionally, you know. Nothing over the top, just kind of matter of fact. There's no real cartoonishness to J.J. Dillon in this promo that I sent you and stuff. I kind of miss that in professional wrestling. Don Callis is a little too...
Oh, my God. He's tedious. And he also does not get over his people. He gets himself over.
Right.
And like, you can't look at J.J. Dillon and be like, wow, J.J. Dillon's really getting himself over here. J.J. Dillon's always very much part of the scene. He's never trying to upstage Flair, Tully, and Arn.
He's the spice. He's not the main course.
And
he's
there. Knows that. I have never seen a J.J. Dillon segment where he has tried to overwhelm the horsemen. Not ever. I mean, it might exist. I'm sure he taped a lot of them, but... I can think of Don Callis stuff all the time where he's overwhelming his faction and, you know, being overbearing.
There's one, but I classify these as dad jokes type of a thing where it's when Tully and Arn are their last feud against the Midnight Express, and he's talking trash about Jim Cornette, and but it fits the character because he is so full of himself. And he's talking about what he's going to do with that tennis racket if Jeff Cornette comes around. But it comes, I mean, and he's like making like halitosis jokes and stuff. And they're so cornball that they're corpsing Arn and Tully a little bit. You know, they kind of do that villain laugh, like, ah, ha, 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 kind of a thing. But it doesn't upstage them at all in any way. No,
and like Arn and Tully were always willing to let JJ do the talking in those moments. They could do it, but they're always down to let JJ talk.
Anything else about the even the match itself?
I liked Wyndham's lariat a lot.
It's
so good.
And the way he hits the ropes. That's always the thing for me for Barry Wyndham. He's 6'7", 6'8", and he hits those aren't WWE ropes. This is a smaller ring than WWE was, and they're the cable type of ropes. So when he hits them, he gets some spring off of them.
Yeah.
And that's always been the thing that just impresses. Like, there are better Barry Wyndham matches than this. Like, the Flair matches he had, a couple of those, really good, but they're like 45 minutes long. I didn't want to have to put you through that kind of a thing. But, yeah, no, his lariats and the way he hits those ropes are always the thing that I watch and go, my God, he's good.
Yeah. And then, like, you know, last, just like small note, you kind of just have to go with the idea that Wyndham, and this is one thing with more modern turns in this, I do get the psychology around this. Wyndham Arn and Tully are beating up on Wyndham for most of this match. And you kind of have to just go with the notion that Wyndham was in on this idea that he was going to get punched in the face a whole bunch before turning on the other guy.
Yeah, or, I mean, for me on this one, I do that same thing when I watch turns. It's like, why are you waiting till the end of the match to turn on a guy to do that thing?
I go back, and I mean, obviously, you got to have a match, but then, like, it does sort of make more sense, like, once you get Lex Luger in the ring, the three of you just corner him like a pack of dogs and just beat the crap out of him.
Which is the Flair thing with Sting, which is fantastic, but when they're fighting Arn and Pillman. They set up that tag match, and Sting goes to tag, and Flair just gets in the ring and just goes after Sting. But they do play up the confusion of Arn and Tully over this. They're kind of looking around going, during the turn, they're like, what's going on here? Because Barry just snaps. And he just goes, the hell with this. I'm tired of dealing with it, and slams him. And JJ starts celebrating. You just see Arn and Tully kind of look at each other going, the hell's going on right now? We have, because they're like, okay, maybe it was a plan, maybe it was something that was, well, maybe he's thinking about the offer or whatever, or maybe it's just they had no idea that he was sick of this crap too. And Barry just goes, I'm joining you guys right now. It's like, oh, okay, cool, you're our new best friend, how's it going? And Flair kind of puts that over. It's like, yes, now you're running with us, you can have any woman you want. Not that you couldn't before. Flair.
Oh, Rick.
But we'll close the book on Shake Them Ropes from there. Chris will have his pick for Vader Club. I don't know. Do you have a neighborhood you're looking in that we can tease? Or
I don't yet. Okay. I'm gonna think about this. I don't know. I haven't decided. I have not decided.
There is nothing wrong with that. I will tweet out when I know, or it'll come up on the show, and you can go back and watch it for yourself. But this has been Shake Them Ropes. You can follow me on Twitter at CrapGame13. You can follow the show at Shake Them Ropes, all one word. I am also on Fight Game Media. I do the Dynamite Show with Paul Fontaine. About 20 minutes after Dynamite goes off the air, we go live on YouTube. It drops into your podcast feeds for free the next day. We do a thorough deconstruction of that week's Dynamite and any news surrounding it. Chris is going to do his plugs right now.
I can be found on Instagram, Instagram.com/DOCTOR_NOV. I teach music lessons. I'm so good at it, they even hire me to do it at other places. But if you'd like to get music lessons for yourself at less cost than at those other places, please hit me up on the Instagram. I am happy to teach, or you can email me at chrisdomembrino@gmail.com. It's also a fine place to tell me what a piece of shit I am, if that's how you feel.
No, we don't need to do that. Just positive notes to Chris. Positive notes.
Positive. Yeah, that's it. Spotify? So do that. Yeah, Spotify. New song coming out this week. It's called The Olive Branch. I am excited about it. The mastering process is underway. I will be making a call with the guy who's doing the mastering here this weekend. And it will be up on Spotify and other things later this week. cool song. Really like the guitar solo on it in particular. And I think the theme about trying to make peace offerings to people who don't really want peace maybe has resonance with other people than just myself.
Oops, I almost ended the meeting there.
End the meeting!
I'm trying to...
I'm done with this show.
Hello. Do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches. But there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.